It's Lee Marcetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the first star chef of the Western world. Two centuries before food TV, one man shaped a new destiny for cooks. Starting out dirt poor, unlettered, and alone, Antonin Carême achieved wealth, fame, and an unheard-of independence. In the process, he reshaped French cuisine. Well, the Stearns have found a surprise, a dynamite restaurant chain, Burgerville, in the Northwest. It's the best ice cream makers, tested and attested to by Christopher Kimball of Cooks Illustrated. We go to Seattle for a dating service of sorts, the Great Wine Oyster Match. And our man in Athens calls in with what those training tables are really like. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Come for you to be alive again.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's the world's first celebrity chef. He never cooked in a restaurant, never had a TV show. He was Antonin Carême, and he lived 200 years ago in France. His family left him at age 9 to starve on the streets of Paris, and from that, Carême went to telling kings when he might be available to cook for them. His biographer, Ian Kelly, has the story. We get the picks of the best ice cream makers from the man who does ruthless testing, Christopher Kimball of Cook's Illustrated Magazine. In Seattle, we get a firsthand experience with the bliss factor, how to create a perfect date, mating the right oyster to the right wine. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, we're going to do something that I don't think we have ever done in all our conversations with you, and that is to talk about a fast food restaurant that we absolutely adore.
A chain of fast food restaurants. I think there are 39 of them, all in the Pacific Northwest, and this is one of the very few chains that we really love eating at that has terrific food. I feel no qualms about recommending.
This is really taking you guys down a different path. I have never heard this kind of stuff from you. What's it like? What is this place?
It's called Burgerville. And yes, indeed, the burgers are wonderful. But what we really love about Burgerville is that it makes a huge effort to serve primarily, if not exclusively, regional Northwest food. In other words, when it's filbert season.
Also known as hazelnut.
Also known as hazelnut
yes,
season.
Yes, for the rest of us. Yeah, yeah.
You get hazelnut chocolate milkshakes.
With real fresh hazelnuts.
Made with real fresh hazelnuts. Throughout the spring and summer, whatever berries and fruits are available. Marion berries, peaches, strawberries, blueberries. Those are made into milkshakes when they're at their ripest.
This sounds like yuppie fast food.
It really is.
But at non-yuppie prices. I mean, the prices are fast food prices. In fact, one of the most delicious meal I had there was a new kind of bacon cheeseburger that they were making. The beef was from Oregon beef. The bacon was made in a smokehouse in nearby Oregon. The buns were baked in Portland. Even the pickles came from a place in Washington State.
And they use the Oregon blue cheese.
And it's topped with this wonderful Rogue River Oregon blue cheese. And I think it costs $4.95.
And it's like, plastic chairs and tables and no pretenses, but delicious regional food.
Who's doing this? I mean, who are the people who started this thing?
Well, we can tell you who the chef is.
It's a guy named George Brown is the executive chef. And he's hilarious, actually, because when you get him onto the topic of local food, it's like he will not stop talking about it. He makes these three berry smoothies that he wants to tell you about. When he talks about hazelnuts, it's like poetry. Because he talks about how a raw hazelnut is kind of drab and bland, but he said, once it gets roasted, it has that flavor, he said, that sings to your tongue like a harpy.
This guy looks like Paul Bunyan. I mean, I haven't, really put him up against a wall and measured him.
So what are these places, what do they look like?
Just like every other crappy fast food franchise. I mean, they're plastic. I mean, they have, big kind of neon signs outside that say Burgerville.
Molded furniture.
The seats are molded. Mm-hmm. I would say, I think he told us that 40 to 50% of the business is through the drive-through window. So it is nothing about it that looks wonderful or feels wonderful, except the food is just extraordinarily good. It's really local.
I think if James Beard, who also was an Oregonian, had decided to become a fast food chef, this is what would have been the result.
Where are they really? Are they sort of between Portland and Seattle, or do they go further? Where are they?
The ones that we found were on the Oregon-Washington border around Vancouver, around Portland. There are billboards for them all around. My favorite billboard said it had a picture of a milkshake because they're famous for these wonderful milkshakes they make. And the only words on the billboard were "woohoo, tonsillectomy."
Why?
Well, because when you have a tonsillectomy, then you get to drink a milkshake.
Oh. Oy.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
The Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they visit here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Julia Child left us recently. Now, so many today know her as a caricature. The Saturday Night Live cook, The Voice. I used to love her phone messages. Lynn, this is Julia Child. Like, who else could it be? But Julia was no caricature. She was the real deal. I first fell in love with her writing, the precision and the generosity of it. I loved the perfection of recipes, which never failed. I mean, the only thing that Julia did not tell you was to turn on the kitchen light. She was my first teacher on TV, and in the early 70s, when I had my first real job in food, running a department store series of cooking classes, Julia chose my kitchen to do her first public food demo. The store was over the moon. I was terrified. Julia arrived with entourage. She took one look at me, put her arm around my shoulders, and said, "Dearie, show me your kitchen. Tell me all about what you do." My goddess was human. She was merciful, funny, and seemingly fascinated by my work. I've watched her do this again and again over the years. It was never about her. She was the consummate deflector. Well, she cooked that day. Romped is probably a better word, to a standing room only crowd who'd camped out overnight. When a big banner was raised, "Viva Julia," in red, white, and blue, my boss thought that I'd planted it. No way. It was her fans. They were totally spontaneous. And that's the way it's been all the years that I've known her. She followed her curiosity and her sense of mischief, and we went along for the ride. Consumer Reports does for all kinds of merchandise, Cook's Illustrated Magazine and its TV show America's Test Kitchen does for cooking equipment. They take no advertising, and they are relentless in their testing. If you want the straight story on what's the best spatula or knife, this is where you go first. Christopher Kimball is creator and editor of Cook's Illustrated, and he hosts America's Test Kitchen. Chris, it's good to have you back.
The relentless part of me has to come out here.
It's always seeking truth, aren't you?
Well, yeah, we don't always get it, but we're looking for it.
Well, I'd like to talk about ice cream makers, but I'm going to backpedal a bit, because considering the great ice cream that's out there, is it worth making it at home?
Fair question. One thing that most people don't think of, and we do recommend it cooks, is making a sorbet or sherbet or Italian ice, because they only have four or five ingredients. There's no custard. You don't have to cook anything on top of the stove. And in fact, those homemade desserts, sherbets and sorbets, et cetera, are actually much better than what you can buy in the store. So if you think about frozen desserts rather than just ice cream, the answer is yes.
Okay. Well, now, how do those makers out there break down? Because when I go and look at them, I see hand cranks and there are electrics. What are the actual different types of ice cream makers?
Well, there are four kinds. There's the trust fund ice cream maker, which is the $600. And this is when you have two things, a ton of money and a lot of storage space. Usually the latter is the thing most people don't have. And the Lucino is about $600, and it has its own air conditioning, you know, chilling unit, electric unit in it. So there's no ice, there's no freezing a canister overnight in the freezer. It makes terrific ice cream, but you need to have a place to store it, and you need $600 you don't need. So great machine, expensive, and of course you got to put it somewhere.
Okay. Type number two?
Type number two is sort of an old-fashioned one, which is the White Mountain ice cream maker. It's $200. It has an electric, you know, stirrer machine on top in a bucket. The great thing about this is that it makes a gallon of ice cream, which in my house is important with four children.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing is you need a back porch because it makes so much noise that if you were in an apartment, the co-op board would evict you instantly. And you also need to use ice and rock salt. It's messy. It's noisy. It's wet. But it makes a tremendous amount of ice cream, which for me is really important. But for most people, they probably would opt for something cheaper and easier to use.
Okay. But what I'm thinking about the White Mountain is, to me, that always looks like the classic old-fashioned ice cream maker. Isn't it look like a wooden bucket, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a wooden bucket. And, you know, I have one. I use it in almost every week in the summer. But it is messy and noisy. But if you like that old-fashioned feeling and you want to make a lot of ice cream, the problem is a lot of these machines make a quart to maybe 2 quarts or a quart and a half.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to go all the trouble to make ice cream, I think you might as well have 4 quarts.
Well, I go.
Well, yeah, under all conditions, I prefer 4 quarts to 2. Anyway.
Okay, so now the prices are coming down. What's next?
Yeah, now you get into the cheap, more modern, inexpensive home models, and there are two kinds, and they run roughly $50 to up to $100. One does have an electric motor for stirring the mixture. And we love the Krupps La Glacière, which was about $60, and it works great, and it's a nice machine. Cuisinart also makes one. It's called the Cuisinart Flavor Duo ice cream maker, and that actually you can make two separate 1 quart amounts. So you could have vanilla and chocolate, for example.
Uh-huh.
But both of those work well, and they stir the mixture for you. We also tried the hand crank models, and there was one Donvier, D-O-N-V-I-E-R. That came out many, many years ago, I think in the 80s. And that's hand crank, so every few minutes you got to crank it. And it was okay, but not nearly as good as the constant stirring with the electric machine. Now, the problem with both of these models is, of course, you got to take the canister, which lines the machine, and put that in your freezer overnight. And the freezer does have to get down to zero. I called the company, one of these companies, and said, well, what if it only gets down to 10 or 11?
Right.
And they said, well, it really doesn't work that well. So you do have to have a freezer that does actually chill the canister with a coolant to zero. That's the only way you'll make good ice cream.
So out of all of these, if you had to pick one, which one would you pick?
Me personally?
Yeah.
White Mountain, because I make a gallon of ice cream, and I like the noise, and I like the mess, and no one said cooking's easy, you know, so I love it.
And you have a back porch.
It's like having a fifth kid, you know? I mean, it's messy, it's noisy, it's just like my kids.
Well, we'll still get some homemade ice cream out of this. Hey, Chris, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Christopher Kimball is founder and editor of Cooks Illustrated magazine, host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen, and author of The Kitchen Detective. Now, you can find his ice cream maker picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Each week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish. This week, it's fresh Thai curry. We also send along technique and shopping tips. Best of all, the newsletter is free. So sign up at that place where we solve all of life's little problems, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the first star chef, an oyster dating service, and a report from the Athens training tables. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. In this day of every chef having a press agent on his speed dial, we tend to think the celebrity cook is a modern invention. Well, it isn't. The concept was created 200 years ago by a French chef named Antonin Carême, and he was every bit as hot then as Emeril is now. Celebrity was his middle name, and his story is pure theater. And I mean that literally, because it actually is theater. Actor and writer Ian Kelly has written the first biography of Carême in English. He's also created a one-man play of the same name. The book and play are called Cooking for Kings, The Life of Antonin Carême, the First Celebrity Chef. Ian Kelly joins us from London. Ian, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So, Ian, how does an actor get tangled up with a chef who died 200 years ago, just about?
I guess partly through love of food in the first place, generally. It's something that's always been part of the way I've prepared for characters, for roles in the theatre or in film, is to try and find out a little bit about the food of a period. Uh-huh. It's a great excuse to get the cast together and have a party. So I had always loved that aspect of theatre, the sort of the food crossover. But specifically, this story I came across and first fell in love with as a story that I might chase maybe for a screenplay or a play, because I came across the story of Carême a number of times. He's as you say, the first celebrity chef, but also a man just kind of offstage from great world events, chef to Napoleon and then the Prince Regent in England and the Tsar in Russia. So I kept on coming across his story kind of by accident, but because of my life as an actor, and thought it would be a great story.
Now, this is the early 1800s, and you say in the beginning of the book that this was a time of surfaces. What do you mean by that?
I think the late 18th, early 19th century is very much like our own. It's a time obsessed with glamour and with celebrity. It's a very decorous age, but there's a kind of a violent undertow, and all those things, you know, struck chords with now.
What was his contribution to food?
There are a few key issues with Carême that can't be ignored. He's the guy who invents the chef's hat. He's the guy who, for the first time, creates the vol-au-vent and the souffle and sort of ideas we still have. But more important than any of that, it seems to me, although that was great fun to discover, he's the first chef who becomes rich and famous publishing cookbooks. And that is vital in the history of food, the idea of kind of taking food outside of palace walls, if you like, and explaining to the wider world how to eat, how the great and the good ate. And Carême was very canny at all of that. He's, you know, he's not only a great chef, he's also a really impressive self-publicist. And it's that makes him truly the first celebrity chef, the way in which he's manages to play the publicity game and make publishing work for him.
What in his food, for instance, I understand that he was a man who created these incredible centerpieces. Now, that wasn't a new idea. That had been going on for hundreds of years. But can you paint a word picture for us of what it was like to sit at a table that he did?
I think the most important thing to realize about the food of Carême's period, certainly the early part of his career, was that most of the food was on the table as you entered the dining room. Service à la Française, which is how people ate, not just in France, but in Britain and in America at the time, in grand occasions, everything was presented on the table. And the centerpiece, therefore, had particular importance. And Carême initially became famous for these pièces montées. He called them extraordinaires because they were extraordinary, towering centerpieces, up to several feet tall, made out of sponge sugar. And these were almost the the culinary equivalent of the ridiculous follies that people were building in their gardens or decorating their cities with. And this was to be wondered at the centre of your table, and just little bits of it were to be eaten. Maybe the little bit of moss made out of marzipan around your fallen column. Maybe just little meringues that were placed around the rocks at the bottom of your Grecian temple. And very often, for the grander occasions, he'd have several of these marching down the table. He was an amazingly skillful man, but one should think of it almost like sculpture rather than food.
Amazing. And also, from what I understand, these things could be like 6 feet high, right?
They could be colossal. The guy was a frustrated architect as well as a chef, and what he wanted to do was impress people with what he could build as well as what he could cook. And these things were... they were the event. You know, we look for event now in food, maybe because of the style of the restaurant, the line that goes round the block that, you know, you have to queue up through to get in. These mm-hmm. are some of the additions to the drama of food that we expect nowadays. But then the drama of food was a lot about that one moment when you first saw the table. And the most impressive thing on the table would be the pièce montée in the centre, the centrepiece. And if you like, the nearest thing we have to it now is the wedding cake, is something which is a centerpiece, which celebrates an occasion, which actually isn't just about taste, is also about the look and the style and the kind of the moment. It's theatrical, you know. It's like he's a set designer, and these could be vast, but they were competing with a whole table display culture that was theatrical. It was like the window display at Tiffany's. There was a table that they had at the palace in London at Carlton House, which had a whole stream running down the centre of it, with gold and silver bridges that went over, which would be decorated with, you know, little fruits and bonbons and sweets that you could pick at. So there was that kind of culture on the table, which was partly about display and partly about food. It's a great idea, isn't it? I mean, it's just, you want to be there to experience all of this. And that's what Carême's cookbooks are full of. Not only did he write about this, but also he drew them. The most spectacular illustrations that I've tried to include in my book, actually expressing what it was like to have this visual wonder in front of you. He, like his contemporary Brillat Savarin, said, you know, you eat first with your eyes, and it's a very important point.
What a vision to leave us with. Ian Kelly, thank you.
Thank you.
Actor, playwright, and biographer Ian Kelly is the author of Cooking for Kings, The Life of Antonin Carême. His one-man play on Carême was staged in New York City. Ian left us with a recipe straight from Carême's writings. It's orange flower and pink champagne jelly. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. You always hear that oysters are best in the months with the letter R in them, the cool seasons. But there's one place where oysters are great all summer. The Northwest, Seattle. In fact, oysters are such a big deal there that Seattle Seafood Authority John Rowley created an oyster dating service. It's an annual competition where a bunch of experts taste the oysters with different wines looking for the best matches. When we were in Seattle, one of those experts gave us a lesson in pairing the mollusk with the grape. Greg Hinton is general manager of Elliott's Oyster House in Seattle. He had chilled wines and a variety of oysters waiting for their blind date.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through?
Okay, you have been an official judge. I'd like you to show me how I get oyster and wine to get together on a date. How do you taste?
Okay. You have your oyster. And we're going to use the Kumamotos, which the Kumamotos are what we use in the competition, because they're one, when you're eating that many oysters with that many wines, you can't have great big oysters. You're just going to get too full.
So we've got all these oysters arranged on a pile, a mound of ice, and there's wedges of lemon, and there's some fresh seaweed. What do I do?
There is. We don't use any lemon, though, with the wines, because you just want the oyster right. and just the wine together. So you pick up your oyster.
Okay. All right.
Oyster in left hand.
Oyster in left hand. My
technique is to hold my finger on it so I can just kind of slide it right off into my mouth.
All right. Go ahead. All right. Wait.
Slurp it in. Don't swallow it. Give it a couple of bites. A mouthful of wine.
Oh, apples. Apples. It was like apples and brine and sea. And the oysters are, oh, they're clean and salty. And the aftertaste is sort of sweet, appley, and nice oyster. Isn't that a terrible description? Okay, but you're the judge. What do you get out of it?
The bliss factor was pretty good for you. I could tell by the look on your face. And the bliss factor is just how the flavors combine. There's not a lot of wines that really go great with oysters.
What did we just have?
We had Snoqualmie Vineyard Sauvignon Blanc. And this is one actually a couple of years in a row. It's a Washington State wine. The Sauvignon Blanc has that crispness. It's got a great acidity and a really clean finish. That's what cuts with the salt of the oyster so that it complements the oyster like that did. But it doesn't fight with it. It doesn't combat it and overpower the flavor of the sea.
Okay, so wine number two. Right? Another Kumamoto?
Another Kumamoto.
It is kind of hard to pop that oyster in my mouth, hold it there, and then get the wine in there. Oh, my. All right. No. That's different. Now, that has more acidity. The oyster, the thing I can't get over is these oysters just melt in your mouth. They're so creamy. Okay. This wine for me disappears. It leaves behind its suggestion of grapefruit and grapes. What a novelty, a wine that tastes like a grape. But it leaves that behind. It's not quite as pronounced as the first one.
This wine, and that's why I chose these, because the Washington State wine has that apple and pear real crisp flavors. This is a Lake Sonoma winery. Dry Creek, and it has that typical California. It's a little warmer area. It has that the flavors that are a little richer, a little more full, but still because of that great acidity and that tartness that comes from those grapefruit flavors, it's different flavor profile, but still finishes at the end where it just leaves you wanting another one, and that's what a great oyster wine does.
So now number three. Okay, number three, we're going to go up here. Let's try this. All right, I've got my oyster. Wine number three. Oh, now that just opens up like a flower. That's really nice.
That's one of my favorites.
Now, what are you tasting?
The bliss is good. Okay. It's, again, the flavors meld together. With that one, I get a lot of the oyster. It's just the real strong oyster flavor, but it's just this, it's the sweetness of the oyster that's coming out from this wine, which is a Pinot Grigio, and it's coming out with a little bit of lemon and a little bit of that lime. It's just a slight tropical kind of flavor, but just
tropical.
Just slight, not over the top.
And what wine is it?
This is the La Familia Pinot Grigio from California. Part of the Mondavi family, and this is a multiple year winner also. Just sells a tremendous amount here.
Average prices of the wines?
The average retail price in the grocery store is probably around a $15 bottle of wine that is available when they're available retail. Some of them are only available restaurant.
Okay, so not wildly high priced wines.
Correct. Yeah, they're very affordable and just great for people that can, you know, be able to pair some of the top 10 winners.
Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been very fun.
Greg Hinton is general manager of Elliott's Oyster House in Seattle. Okay, I admit it. I'm hooked. Each night I start out to do something else and end up watching the Olympics. They're addictive. You know, there's so much
much obsessing over tenths of seconds, metals, and their colors, few people are tallying what is really important to some of us. We have Jay Wiener on the phone from Athens. Jay is sports business reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune newspaper. So, Jay, let's get to the heart of the matter. How's the food?
You know, I just had lunch, which is a rare event here when you cover an Olympics. Sleep and eating are really not great options around here. And I went to a nice little restaurant not far from the main press center. It was called Page, or maybe Page, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And I had stuffed tomato and stuffed pepper with some rice stuff in it.
Yeah,
a Greek salad, being here in Greece. You know, they put a block of feta cheese there that you could, like, caulk your bathroom with. It's so big, you know? And it was great.
Sounds fabulous. Now, do you get a chance to see or to eat with the athletes, I mean, to learn about what they're eating?
I get a chance to learn about what they're eating, but I do not get a chance to eat with them. I have been to the Olympic Village, but access to the innards of the village is restricted.
Uh-huh.
And so here's what I know is that the cafeteria is open 24 hours a day.
Right.
And I know that it is something like 110,000 square feet. I think the number is something like 24,000 meals a day. And I think that's because, you know, athletes are in and out. And the last time I spoke with an athlete about it, he said this was in the first couple days of the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
A lot of Asian, Chinese, and Japanese food. And I'm not sure if as the games move along there's a transition to different national foods or not. And then, of course, at the Athletes Village, there's a McDonald's. I hate to tell you this.
Do any of the teams travel with a cook? I mean, I would imagine some of the people really need certain kinds of nutrients and that kind of stuff.
Here's what I do know is that when you look at them and say, hey, what kind of diet are you on? What do you eat? They say, like, what do you mean? You know, you'd think that these people are fueling themselves up with the highest octane, you know, fuel. And the fact is they exercise and train so much that if it isn't nailed down, they munch on it. And so I don't know if some of the teams would bring their own cooks. I'm guessing that the NBA players and the women's basketball players, since they're staying on the Queen Mary, are getting a little bit better food than the
maybe.
People in the village. But, you know, you have to remember, too, there are 201 countries here, including some of the poorest countries in the world.
Right.
And the Olympic Village is really a treat for many of the you know, people who come to compete here. It isn't kind of like going to the college dormitory, you know. So there's kind of two sides to the story of what the food is like there. In general, I know that the American athletes who I've talked with say the food is plentiful and it's okay. But again, I've really been shocked at the lack of scientific approach to eating most of these athletes.
Hey, Jay, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jay Wiener is business sports reporter for the Star Tribune newspaper in Minneapolis. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Why are Olympic winners crowned with wreaths of olive branches? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number's 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, why are Olympic winners crowned with wreaths of olive branches? Well, the olive wreath is the official symbol of this summer's Olympics. It is the symbol of peace, democracy, and exceptional achievement. The circle of the wreath symbolizes an equal union, linking the past with the present. In ancient Greece, the olive tree was the plant of Athena, the goddess of wisdom, reason, and ability. An olive wreath was the highest honor that you could receive. In fact, the olive tree became the sacred tree of Athens. And all of this makes sense because, you see, olive trees live and give fruit for centuries. In fact, some are over 1,000 years old. But the plant takes great faith and nurturing. You plant an olive tree, you have to wait sometimes over a decade before you see an olive on it. Something to think about while you're watching the games.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the lines. We have got Ellie calling from Portland on the line. Hey, Ellie, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. couple weeks ago, one Sunday morning, I was making blueberry muffins, and the recipe called for 2 eggs. And my husband had bought sort of smaller, medium-sized eggs, and I thought, it just struck me as very strange. I thought, gee, should I use 3 eggs because you can get jumbo eggs? I have a great confusion on whether you should just do the amount of eggs, whatever size they are for a recipe, or adjust it. And if you do add an extra egg or delete an extra egg because you cut a recipe in half,
right,
what effect does that have on the thing you are baking?
That's a great question. And it comes down, and baking is really the key to this because, you know, baking is about chemistry.
Right.
I mean, all cooking is, but if you decide you're going to do scrambled eggs with small eggs, you get, less scrambled eggs.
Right.
But the way eggs work in cakes and muffins and anything that is baked, sometimes they're leaveners. They enrich, for instance.
Right.
If you use, if something calls for egg whites as an addition to just the yolks, they tend to dry a cake very slightly, which is maybe desirable in that particular recipe.
Right.
So here's the deal. Almost every recipe, if it doesn't indicate a size, is really calling for large eggs.
Uh-huh.
And if you figure each large egg weighs about 2 ounces, that means each large egg is about 1/4 cup.
Right.
All right? And you've only got small eggs, and it calls for 2 eggs. You just keep cracking those eggs until you get 1/2 cup of egg. You follow me?
I certainly do.
And because you don't want to mess around with the sizes too much because, I mean, for instance, if it's based on a biscuit with an egg thrown in, that's the kind of recipe that's forgiving. But if it's muffins or cake, you could get into trouble.
Right, right.
And those things can be tricky enough as is, so why fool around?
Right.
But if you remember that and one large egg is more or less the standard for most recipes, that's what authors mean when they say 1 egg.
Right.
And if you remember, it weighs about 2 ounces, and it actually is about 1/4 cup.
Right.
For 1 egg, you can kind of work from there.
Great. So you could cut back if you have jumbo eggs and the recipe only calls for 2.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you'd beat them up.
Right.
You'd have to make a little omelet after
Right.
Well, you know, they'll keep in the fridge.
Right.
Beaten eggs that are raw, keep in the fridge for a couple of days, so you can put them in something else.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much.
Thank you. This is a question that probably a lot of people have. Thanks for asking it.
You're welcome.
You take care.
You too.
Goodbye, Ellie.
Bye-bye.
Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We've got Elizabeth calling. She's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Elizabeth, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I am part of a wonderful church community, an Orthodox church community, that is filled with wonderful Lebanese and Palestinian Middle Eastern people from that kind of Mediterranean area. And they have these wonderful foods, hummus and tabbouleh and fattoush and just, you know, falafel, all those great foods.
Right, right.
And I have, you know, sadly tried to recreate some of those foods, and some of them turn out really, really well for me, and others don't so much. So the first part of my question is there's this great lentil dish called mujadra, and it's lentils and rice.
Oh, yes.
And it has fried onions on top.
Yeah, it's a dish that can be almost addictive. It's so simple.
But the thing is that when it's good, it's really good. But
yeah.
When you don't do it right.
Well, tell me, how do you do it? How do you do it?
Well, you know, you wash the lentils and you soak them in water. You boil them for, I think it's like 20 minutes.
Right. Lentils cook pretty quick.
Yeah. And then you add the rice to them. And then everybody does it a little bit differently. But the recipe that I have calls for salt and pepper to taste, whatever that means.
Yeah. No, but that's really to your taste.
Exactly. And then cumin. I put some cumin in.
Right.
And that's really about it as far as the mujadra, the base of it now, and then you fry up onions for the top of it.
Okay. And yours, you're saying, is just kind of dull?
It's just bland, yeah, and it's very sad.
Well, I think this is the... First of all, don't hesitate to use more salt.
Yeah?
Because both rice and lentils, they're starches, and they absorb salt like crazy.
Really?
Yeah, and they'll, you know, you'll salt something that has lentils or rice in it, you'll go back a half hour later, and you'll think you never added salt to it.
Really?
Because it just, yeah. So don't hesitate with the salt, don't hesitate with the pepper. The other thing is, really brown those onions.
Okay.
You know, don't hold back. And if you want to find some sources for some really wonderful Mediterranean recipes, in addition to your church community,
right,
there are two names to remember.
Okay.
Claudia Roden, R-O-D-E-N. She did her latest, well, not her latest book, but anyway, the book is called The New Middle Eastern Cookbook. She is fabulous.
Really?
And simple recipes, and she's originally from Egypt, if I recall correctly, but she does research. She's a historian, but she's a fabulous cook.
Oh, very good.
And the other person is Paula Wolford.
Paula Wolford?
Yes. Okay. W-O-L-F-E-R-T.
Okay.
And she has done several books on the Mediterranean, but one of the one you might want, because it's about the areas of your community, is called The Cooking of the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay.
Now, I'm turning you on to two of the greatest people in the business when it comes to this area.
Okay.
And there's a lot of cultural information, but their recipes are foolproof, and a lot of them are really simple, like what you're doing.
Okay.
Okay?
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Hey, you are welcome. I mean, what a gift. You're in the middle of this incredible place.
You know, and they're wonderful people with wonderful food and a wonderful culture, and I'm just so blessed by them. So
that's fabulous.
I would just love to be able to help out with the food sometimes.
Well, you know, also, they'll probably love to teach you.
That's very, very true.
Yeah, people love to do that.
Really,
hey,
do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yep, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. And by the way, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago, a new trend began in restaurants, and I've just seen another example of it. If you were opening a new restaurant and you wanted to sound really hip, you gave it a single word title. Well, I was flipping through Food & Wine magazine, and they were talking about where to go next in San Francisco. Now, these are the three restaurants that I saw on the first page. The first one is called Quince. The second one is called Cortez. There are four of them. The third one is called Baraka, and the fourth one is called Tablespoon. I just say, you know, single name. That's it. Don't explain. Okay, guys, call us. 800-537-5252. We have Bridget on the line from Wolfboro, New Hampshire. Hey, Bridget, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello, how are you today?
I am good.
I'm thrilled to be here. I am curious about some grapes that grow out on my stone wall.
Mm-hmm.
When I can beat the raccoons and the bears to it, I do make jelly.
Right.
But I'm mostly interested in finding if there's something I can do with the grape leaves.
Oh, yeah. Have you fooled around with them at all?
I have, but they always taste like leaves.
Yeah, they do tend to taste like leaves, don't they? You know, one of the things that you do with, you know, grape leaves, obviously, mm-hmm. is stuffing them. But
yes.
But before you do anything with them, generally, what you want to do is dip them in boiling water for a few seconds. You know, drop them in the boiling water, count to 10, and then just dump them in a colander and run cold water over them.
I never thought of that.
Now, that helps get rid of some of the leaf taste,
mm-hmm.
okay? But then what you want to do is you can stuff them with anything. I mean, traditionally in Greece, they're stuffed with rice and nuts and meat and that kind of thing. But you could stuff the grape leaves with a mixture of fresh cheese and something like Parmesan and bits of ham and onion and roll them up and then toss them on the grill. Rub them with olive oil. Okay, and then toss them on the grill and just give them a fast sear on a very hot grill outside. And then you nibble on them, and the cheese comes spurting out, and the leaves are a little teeny bit browned.
Ooh,
and
boy, that sounds delicious.
I have to tell you, there's another thing you can do, too. I always talk about this at this time of year. There's a Vietnamese dish where you take very, very thin slices of beef, like round steak that you mm-hmm. slice very thin, and you marinate it with fish sauce and garlic and a little chili and a little lemon.
Mm-hmm.
And you want it really thin. So what you do then is you roll them up almost like, you know, long cigarettes, stick two toothpicks in them. Again, brush them or rub them with oil so that the leaves will brown. And you put that on the grill, but this time medium hot grill, and you cook it until it's browned. And what's going to happen is that the beef will cook. It'll be a little rare. But the beef will cook, and the leaves will get almost charred. And they have this bitter yet really pleasing flavor, and they pick up the spice from the beef. And you eat that with your fingers. It's fabulous. Hey, thanks, Bridget.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it had to happen, guys. Low-carb beer, low-carb bread, right? We are now going to have a low-carb potato. A group of farmers in Florida have developed a potato. It's a member of the russet family. It's going to have one-third fewer carbs, and it's going to be out and in the markets sometime early next year. Now, I figure probably the potato farmers have been really beaten up by the Atkins craze, so we'll see what this tastes like. I'm dying to try it. Hey, want to call us? 800-537-5252. Well, now that the wine cork is fading into history, the screw top is with us. But there is a problem. We consumers associate screw tops with cheap wine. So the race is on to find a great, sexy way of sealing a wine bottle. One entrant is the Vino Lock. It comes from Alcoa Aluminum. Juan Lopez from Alcoa is on the line. Juan, welcome.
Thank you. How are you, Lynn?
I am very good, and I'm dying to know, what is a VinoLock?
VinoLock, like you well said, is a very new closure that was invented in Germany by a medical doctor. And we developed the idea along with the doctor in Germany, and it's basically a glass cork.
A glass cork?
Yes. Instead of using a natural cork or a plastic cork, mm-hmm. you will be using a glass cork, and it's heavier because it's made of glass. It's very elegant, and it would preserve the wine better than any other closure in the market.
But glass is solid, and isn't the idea of a cork that it expands and it absorbs moisture and it seals out air and that kind of thing?
Well, that's the whole point behind this glass cork. It actually has a silicone ring in between the glass, so it will serve as a buffer, and it will actually seal the bottle really, really tight, so there's no oxidation, meaning no oxygen or any air coming into the wine, into the bottle,
and
so that would preserve the quality of the wine.
And then that way the glass couldn't chip.
Exactly.
Yeah. So does this fit any wine bottle?
Yes, we actually are developing a number of bottles along with some of the glass bottle suppliers that will be able to serve any glass bottle in the United States, yes.
So the idea is that vintners would be using this instead of the screw top or a plastic cork?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh. How expensive is this going to be compared to cork or plastic?
It's actually going to be the same as a very good natural cork. So it's going to be more expensive than plastic, but similar to a good natural cork.
So we'll tend to see this more in higher-end wines.
Yes, we will expect to see this in wines that really winemakers want to preserve the quality or want to preserve some kind of image. So, yes.
Is anybody using it right now?
No, we haven't started because we're going to go into production now in the fourth quarter of 2004. But very shortly in 2005, we have a number of customers extremely interested in this, yes.
Well, we'll be looking for it. Juan, thank you.
Thank you.
Juan Lopez is marketing manager for Alcoa Aluminum CSI. That's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Hey, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Joseph Addison. He said, "The person you converse with after the third bottle is not the same man who first sat down at the table with you." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And don't miss out on our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's designed to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Nick Kariakis with help this week from Scott Liebers. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.